Now, was this personal correspondence?
To me.
Now, one second, again, we can't speak at the same time because the recording system will not work. Was this personal correspondence addressed to you?
Yes.
And John intercepted it?
Yes, he did. And when I confronted him, he said, oh, I thought, you know, it was for the center. And I was really angry. And I said, it's obviously that it is written to me. It has my name. It's addressed to me. It says, Dear Ella, you know, I was going by Ella at that time. And he was, well, I'm really sorry, which was a word I heard a lot around there. Sorry, sorry, sorry. Every time I caught him on something, it was sorry, you know.
One second, are you saying, to the best of your recollection, that the letter was addressed to you on the envelope?
Oh, yes, it was.
And John opened it?
Yes, he did.
I believe, I'm not an attorney, but I believe that's illegal.
Oh, I'm sure it was. And I was angry, and I did point it out, and I'm kind of don't like to express my anger, but this really pushed me over the edge because I never opened his letters. Of course, it was addressed to the May Brussels Center, you know, but it was addressed to me, and it was a letter thanking me for this big job I had done for this person, and was a whole bunch of other stuff in it. Anyway, that was just one other thing to add on to the other things, right?
But now, once again, this was personal correspondence addressed to you with your name on the envelope?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, and I still have a letter, matter of fact.
Okay.
In my files.
Okay.
Okay, so, let's see. The other thing I have next on the list was that he would be real lazy, and he'd not prioritize things, and then he would run out of time, causing a crisis. There was constant crises there, which then involved the volunteers and a cleanup of his messes, for, like, deadlines and getting rides and stuff. And it was just the way he dealt with people. Okay, the next thing I have is that playing games with people, figuring out people's weak spots. He was very good at, like, being very personal and trying to, you know, get you to talk about your stuff, and then he'd find out your weak point, as other people will probably point out, and then he would exploit it. In my case, I had confided a whole bunch of personal stuff, which I don't really want to go into, and then he turned it around to, like, milk me. Like, he would say a lot of, he would tell me, I don't like to work with men. They're so messed up. I'm not using the words he used. They're all kind of obscene. And that he was a feminist and how it would a gentle person. These are almost direct quotes. Gentle person. And anyway, later on, he ended up throwing that back on me when I finally confronted him about all these other things that I had been noticing. And I confronted him in the dungeon, as I used to call it, where all the files were kept, which was, I shouldn't have done it. I should have had a lawyer, but now I'm older and I know what I was dealing with. I didn't know it was going to react this way and it was going to destroy the center. Anyway, what ended up happening with that, he threw it right back in my face when I confronted him with a bunch of different things. Probably at that time it was about the letter and about all these other things that he had done to other people. Anyway, how he ended up dealing with it was that it was all my fault and it was my past in that. He weaved everything that I had told him before into that this is all my imagining and that it was my past and that he, quote, was so sad that I was disappointed and how sad it was. But it really was my fault because it was my past. So that's how he dealt with this whole blowout I had with him. The next thing, oh, the newsletter. He had this whole thing that the first newsletter that took forever to come out, the May Brussels newsletter.
Also the only one.
And the only one, mind you. This is really gets to me, all this stuff. Was full of his articles. If anybody sees it, he knows that what I'm talking about. It was mostly all his articles. And there was like one article by the manager of the office, who I can't mention because I don't think she wants to be part of this whole exposing what Judge is about.
Okay.
Anyway, her article was chopped to shreds, and I read the original, and then I read the part that was in the newsletter, and it didn't make any sense the way he had edited it, supposedly. And when I confronted him about it, he just made a joke, quote, chop, chop, and that was it. And then I really got angry, and I came back at him, and I said, well, is this a May Brussels newsletter, or is this a John Judge newsletter? Of course, I'm being real nice about it. And I said, well, why did you destroy this person's article? And he said, well, I didn't really mean to cut it up. I said, well, either you did or you didn't. But you obviously did because you shredded it. So so badly that you can't even tell what it means. So, I mean, I'm just mentioning all stuff. This is day in and day out at the May Brussels Center. Anyway, on to the next thing. Let's see. Next thing was the thing about Wendy, this woman that he had supposedly known from his childhood, but actually, to me, he only had met her and started dating her over the phone.
You claim that he said he knew her from childhood?
Yes, he told two people that, and then two other people that he had known from the childhood. So, see, that was the other thing. He told different things to different people, and that was the other thing I wanted to mention. He treated some people in the center really, really well.
Can you recall the first names of people he treated well?
Yes, he treated Rat very well.
Now, who is Rat?
Dave.
Let's only use first names.
Oh, sorry. Dave.
Okay. Now, that is the individual whom the audience heard discussed by Cayenne. Originally, there were three members of the board of directors: John, this fellow Dave, and Cayenne. And Cayenne described Dave and John as consistently opposing her, and that made it 2-1. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I personally have nothing against Dave, although, you know, I had a good personal relationship, but when things came down, he did side with Judge.
Mm-hmm.
I think out of stupidity, but that's my opinion. And then the other people he treated real well was Jim and Emil.
Neither of whom I know or met.
Yeah, and I really cared for them, and they were good workers, and it really made me angry that he did what he did to me and these other people, and then he treated them, because what it ended up doing is it split us, and then we ignored each other, and it got bigger rift and bigger rift. It was obviously some kind of tactic. I don't know what, but anyway. So this big thing about Wendy, we were very concerned. Part of the group, the other part that was treated well, hey, she's welcome into the center, the part that, you know, the other part of us, the women, basically, we were like, who's this person? You know, you don't know her, but you're starting this big relationship. The reason this comes up is because he was so tight about security. He had all the power. You know, he'd have to interview people before they came over. I couldn't bring over my best friends that I have known 20 years that I would trust my life with, but he would bring this other woman, Terry, through the bus, and then other people, anybody he wanted, mostly women, he'd bring over at his leisure. But we, you know, he wanted me to park my car 2 blocks away from the center. You know, he didn't want me to bring any of my people over. He didn't want my family to know where I work, you know, so it was like double standard. Meanwhile, he's having this big relationship with this Wendy woman, which is his business. But when part of the group was really upset that she was going to be coming out to visit him at the center, you know, we decided that whole week not to be there, and we vanished, which I think was a mistake, because who knows what happened. Not that I'm saying anything happened, but who knows? We didn't know who the hell she was. Anyway, okay, I talked about the checking people out and his discretion with totally freak about security. Okay, let's see. Okay, then I just talked to Cayenne about my concern is if he's constantly lying, how can he not lie when he's on the radio? Do you want a pathological liar to represent the center? What does other researchers feel about his quality of research? Because they started to doubt his, if anything, that he was saying about Jonestown, about all his other stuff. Because if his personal life was so messed up and lying every which way he could, I was starting to wonder, well, gosh, I wonder about his research. And could he be trusted? And who was Wendy? These are all things that I asked Cayenne, which she never responded back. Anyway, then I have an entry, September 13th, 89. Came to a meeting ready to quit with the office manager, and he was so apologetic and saying his favorite word, sorry, that we both decided to stay. And then the next morning, he got up real early, which, by the way, is a real hard, you know, effort on his part, because he usually doesn't get up till like 3 or 4 in the afternoon. He got up to like lay in again on the officer, you know, manager of the office when nobody is around, which that was the other thing. He used to get people when they were alone and then do his thing so there would never be any witnesses. That was a real typical thing he did. Okay, then there was the thing about this Wendy woman again who sent this flyer, which really got me angry. This flyer inviting all these different researchers supposedly that they had invited, which I hear later on that none of these people, including Dave Emery, wasn't invited, and neither was Tom Davis, but all of these names were on this flyer inviting everybody to the grassy knoll about the JFK, blah, 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 assassination. And this flyer was made up and laid out by this Wendy person, sent to Tom Davis's address, not to the Mae Russell Center, because she felt that we didn't have to know about it. The staff did not have to know about it. And I was like, who's this woman? She's not even been around. She doesn't even know Mae Russell. You know, not that I knew her when she was alive, but I'm at least working there. And the way it was just sidetracked away from the center to this other address that we were never supposed to see was just really weird. We're supposed to be somewhat of a collective, not really. Not, you know, we thought it was a collective. Anyway, so that made me wonder what else is going on. And then more personal stuff about how poor he, you know, it's just personal stuff about how poor he was, and then he wanted us to take him shopping, doing his laundry, all his personal stuff.
He would have people do his laundry?
No, take him to go do the laundry.
Okay.
You know, he just used people a lot. I mean, and I was more than willing in the beginning to help him, but then I realized that this is part of his personality, is just to live off people. And the other thing that I did want to mention that somehow I slipped somewhere here, the other thing was that once he had to go up to back to Washington, and he left two people to take care of the collection.
Mm-hmm.
I had heard about this because I was there, and somehow I wasn't there at that point. I don't remember, but I had heard this story anyway. And he later on told me this story, that how these people had rifled, and I don't know who these two people were, rifled through the files and Xeroxed them, and that he felt, quote, violated, and as if, quote, he was raped. But then I had later on found out this all was going to this anarchist shop up in the city. I had later on found out that he had actually okayed this, but it was like telling me, you know, on and on how he had been wronged. This is actually to get very personal with my, it's a long story.
Now let me interrupt, Dan. This was while John Judge was back east getting his things together to relocate to California?
Yes. I'm almost sure that's when it was. It was one time when he was away. I don't know, remember where, because I didn't put a date on this, but it did happen. And he did tell me that he felt violated, and that these two people, I can't remember which one, because sometimes he went to L.A. and sometimes in this, but when he did come back at one point, he had said that these people had rifled through. Actually, it was actually before I came to the center. I'm remembering now.
When did you come to the center?
I came to the center, I think, right around when the Danny Sheehan benefit was.
That was June 17th, 1989.
Exactly. That week is when I began. And he had told me that story, and it must have been the week before when he had to go back for, not the week before, but that time before I came to the center, because later on he had told me this long story. He told me a lot of different stories. Anyway, it was probably to milk me for something else. Anyway, I'd like to get on to some other issues.
Yeah, we are limited for time now.
I know. Okay, just other mind-playing games, which I'll just skip that, just things that he did to me and some other women, you know. Anyway, the other thing was that he did ask me, this is going to be talked about, and Pat already mentioned it, but I was the one that he asked to clean the toilet originally, and I refused to, his private toilet, and then I'm sure everybody else talked about it. I don't know how much they went into that.
No, this has only been related by Pat. She recollected that Betty and Terry were the ones who were asked to clean the toilet. Now, you're saying that you were asked to clean the toilet?
Okay, this is how I remember it. Originally, he came to me to clean his private toilet. There was two toilets at the center, and I was told him I'm more than willing to clean the one out there along with somebody trading off and then John doing one time, blah, 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 so that, you know, if people came over to give us grants, we don't want to look like we're a bunch of slobs. But his private one, I said, no way, you can pay me because I house clean for a living. And he says, no, no. Then he went to Pat, as I understood, and asked her. And she said, no, I won't do it. I'll spray it, and then you can clean up the rest of the mess. And then that's when he went to Betty and Terry. And then you'll hear about that story and how about he said that women know how to clean toilets better and all that stuff.
We will, once again, I want you to, as much as possible, stick to your own experiences
right.
And recollections, because I will be talking with Betty and Terry.
Okay. Well, my recollection is that later on, how this comes back to me, is that later on, after this whole incident, I thought was finished, and that he had cleaned his toilet. He came back to me. This is how it goes to me, as personally, is that, and then he told me how hard it was for him to clean the toilet. When later on, a month, two later, I found out that he didn't even clean the toilet. Okay, that's how it relates back to me. Okay, and I also must mention that personally, he kept on telling me how smart he was, And because I have a slight issue about not being as smart as all the other researchers, which is not, you know, I do my own stuff. I'm a photographer and stuff. But he had to constantly remind me to push me down about how smart he was and how together he was and how what a genius he was. I mean, he must have mentioned that without exaggeration about 20 or 30 times. Just personal things, you know, like, you know, so much for equalitarian and sensitive. And let's see. That's about it that I can remember. I mean, I'm sure there's other little things here and there, but I found him to be quite a disappointment. I really, to sum it up, I really admired him. I put him almost on the level of Mae Brussel, and when I went to work with him, I was still really admired him, and I wanted to do anything, drive him around, you know, cook him dinner, you know, stuff like that, because, you know, he's to me, he was like a warrior. But when I started to work for him and see day in and day out, he was a sham, and that is all I can, you know, that's it. You know,
let me
back that up.
Yeah, I want to get your reaction to what Jonathan Vanken wrote about the demise of the center.
Well.
And let me read this to you. Talking about John Judge, he collected thousands, somewhere in the mid-five figures, then a series of personal conflicts and health problems drove him back to the East Coast. The center collapsed, to be resurrected by Davis and some associates as the Mae Brussel Library in Seaside, California. There was a string of problems with the center, one of them Judge's refusal to open it to the public. According to Davis, the new library will be open. But, says Davis, quote, one of the problems was Dave Emery, unquote. Davis says he personally implored Emery, to whom the Mae Brussel Research Center will always be, quote, so-called, unquote, not to attack the center on his show. In the fall of 1989, Emery burst. Restraining himself for a year, he could no longer hold it in and went on the air accusing Judge of financial improprieties and other sordid acts. In private, Emery is even more vitriolic. Whatever the objective reality of the Mae Brussel Research Center controversy, the version that navigates the canals of Dave Emery's brain is another of his many traumas. What is your reaction to Vanken's description of what happened with the center and Tom Davis's observations in particular?
Well, I was I originally heard you mention it on the air, and I went down because I didn't want to waste my money on his book, and I went and read it, and I was shocked. And I was disappointed because I think, like I mentioned to you, I have my differences with you, Emery, but at the same time, you had nothing. If anything, I had more responsibility with the center because I didn't bring lawyers in and I didn't confront him and I didn't do a lot of stuff. You were on the outskirts. And a matter of fact, as I recollect, you did not attack the center till after it was crashed. And I wished you would have attacked the center while he was there, because maybe this might have not happened if he would have been exposed.
I attacked the center after most of the volunteers quit. I guess they all didn't. After Tom Davis and Will Robinson removed the core of May's files, after the picnic on the grassy knoll, about which I will have more to say later, and when John entered into open defiance of the wishes of the Brussel family, as represented by Kyan Brussel.
Yes. I thought you did very well, considering what was coming down. No, you did not. I don't even know if you could call it attack. Defend the center. And like I said, I wished we would have thought of something else before, sooner, because maybe the center wouldn't have crashed if Judge would have been exposed. And definitely, I disagree with Tom Davis. I don't know where he came up with that, because he was barely, I'm sorry, Tom, but you were barely there at the center. Once in a while you came. I don't know how you could think that Emery was to blame for the demise of the center. That's not true. It fully resides on Judge's shoulders.
Well, again, I had sat down with Kyan the week, 2 days before May died, and I related my own experiences with John Judge to date and said I thought there were going to be very serious problems. And at that point, however, people were dismissing my assessment of John as a personality conflict. That apparently is still Tom Davis's opinion. But it really, I was wounded by May's death and had a lot of work to do, and I did not want a conflict with John Judge. That is why I offered him the position of being my co-host in an attempt to preclude what eventually went down. I now know that that was inevitable, but that's why I did not speak up until it became apparent that I had to speak up. But, A, I want to thank you for participating in the broadcast, and I hope that you stay well.
Yes, well, thank you for setting the record straight. Bye.
Bye-bye now, Aya.
We are now going to change the tape, and I'm going to play the last of the interviews with the volunteers that I have. And obviously this is quite time-consuming, so I was not in a position to interview everyone. I didn't even know some of the people, the Jim and Emil that you heard alluded to. That's the first time I'd ever heard their names. But we're now going to hear from a very close friend of both Mays and Cayenne's, a woman named Karen Gutt, who was also on the temporarily expanded board of directors and who helped Cayenne clean the May Russell Research Centers. And once again, I want to emphasize that the subjective reaction, the subjective impressions of the volunteers should perhaps be taken, some of it anyway, with a grain of salt. I do think it's important to allow people to give their recollections of what happened by way of setting the record straight. But some of these things should not, well, like I say, you should take it with a grain of salt. Some of it's subjective recollection and impression. But some of the experiences that people had with John having people clean his bathrooms, etc., explains the reason why most of the volunteers decided to quit. The last interview we're going to hear now is about 14 minutes in length, and this is Mays and Cayenne's good friend, Karen Gutt, who was a member, as I said, of the temporarily expanded May Russell Research Center board.
The next participant in the May Russell Research Center that we're going to be hearing from is Karen Gutt, a very good friend of both Mays and Cayenne's, someone who worked at the center and who was appointed to the board of directors during the closing stages, I guess one could say, of the May Russell Research Center. One thing I wanted to ask you, Karen, in my discussion with Cayenne, there was a difference in our recollections of a meeting that was to take place on the evening of Friday, November 11th of 1988. Mm-hmm. You recall that this meeting was to resolve the differences between John Judge and myself. I wanted a number of people whom I knew and who had experienced some of the things that I objected to about John's behavior, I wanted them to be there to bear witness to what had happened, precisely because it was my fear and my considered opinion that if people did not hear from these people, then they would dismiss the situation as a personality conflict between myself and John Judge. Now, I did not go to that meeting on the advice of counsel, who was also going to be there, because John did not want these people to be in attendance because he felt this would compromise the security of the May Russell Center.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I remember, perhaps because of that, that this dinner gathering was to take place at the May Russell Research Center. John objected to these people being there because he did not want them knowing where the center was.
Uh-huh.
Cayenne remembers the gathering as being at your house. Do you recall which situation was accurate?
This was in November 88.
This was specifically, it was a Friday evening, November 11th of 1988. I remember because it was 11-11-88, which is an easy thing to remember. Also because it was, frankly, an upsetting and wounding experience for yours truly.
Right.
Was this dinner to be at the center or at your house?
I think originally it was going to be at the center, and then I don't remember how that decision was changed, but it was then changed to be at my house. And I think partly because of John Judge's fears about the security.
Well, that's makes John's objections then all the more strange, because if they were going to be at your house, how would that compromise the security of the May Russell Center? That is probably why I recall the gathering as being at the center, but if John did not want them knowing where the center was, and that was the objection that was voiced, how could their being in attendance at your house compromise that?
I don't know.
I simply wanted to ask you that, mm-hmm. because after speaking with Cayenne, that was a question that I had. Now, Karen, I want you to relate as best you can your own experiences with the center and with John Judge and what it was, in your opinion and to the best of your recollection, that happened that caused the center to collapse.
Okay. Well, the first thing I want to say is that I became personally involved with the center because I was friends with Mae Bressel and her daughter, Cayenne, and I helped move a lot of Mae's things into the center from Carmel to Santa Cruz and did some work organizing files and organizing fundraising events there. But the other volunteers that you've spoken to were much more worked on a much more regular basis within the center. So in a way, I was on the outside of some of the inner workings with the volunteers. And when I first started noticing that there were problems at the center, it came from direct communications from the volunteers themselves. And I know that you have these problems detailed by the volunteers themselves, but their complaints were so varied and so many that Cayenne and I and some other people that were concerned for the center decided to form a legal board so that we would have a structure to deal with any problems that were arising, especially with John Judge as acting director. And there were so many complaints that we felt like there may come a time in the future that we would need to ask him to step down, and we needed to have a structure to balance the power of decision-making and control at the center. So she invited a lawyer, and he joined us, and we created this board. And all along during this process, I did notice that John Judge seemed to be, he wasn't approving at first that we were kind of expanding this decision-making power to a whole board, and he seemed uncomfortable with it. But one of the complaints that the volunteers, you know, felt strongly about, and that I also felt strongly about, was this whole issue of security and who could know where the center was and all of this. And I agreed that it was a security issue, but John kind of made a breach in that policy by inviting this woman, Wendy, that he was personally involved with, to come live with him at the center. And I think I, as well as many of the other volunteers, didn't feel like this was appropriate at all, and a lot of us had concerns. We didn't know who she was or where she came from, or, you know, but we did know that, I mean, one of the complaints that the volunteers had was that John was on the phone with her constantly, and that a lot of the work that he had been doing was decreasing as he was having increased involvement with her. And then she ended up moving into the center, whereas other people weren't even allowed to know where the center was that we trusted. So people were feeling a lot of feelings about this woman in particular and this breach of security, especially because they were personally involved with the center and felt personally unsafe. And so we called a board meeting to discuss the issue, and this woman, Wendy, was present at the meeting. And I don't think anyone was coming right out and saying to her what they were feeling, but the room was filled with tension. You could cut it with a knife. And so finally I spoke to her and I said, Wendy, I think you may be feeling that, you know, there's a lot of tension in this room, and I think I want to spell out what I feel is happening is that we don't know who you are. We don't know where you came from. We don't know your background. And, you know, we have policies right now at the center about who can come in and who can work there, and there needs to be a screening procedure, you know, before someone can just enter into the workings of the center. And Cayenne kind of reinforced that and said, you know, Wendy, if you have worked in this field, you would know that, you know, we can't give you the benefit of the doubt, and why should we? And we need to know your background. And Cayenne at that point asked her, you know, what has your work been in the last 10 years? And this woman responded that she'd worked, you know, kind of vague replies that she'd worked with the media in Washington, D.C., but that mostly she'd been an artist. And Cayenne said, well, I want to know, you know, I need to know what you've been doing and concrete evidence of the work. And if you've been an artist, I want to see the slides. She was really good at kind of pushing this woman to be really confronting her. And the output of that, the ending result of that was that this woman started crying and left the room, and John was really upset, and he ended up resigning from the center. And I think partly because he felt that if he didn't resign, he would have been asked to leave because there was so much dissension.
And as a matter of fact, Karen, as a matter of fact, sorry for interrupting, Cayenne had her brother, who was an attorney, write John a letter instructing him that he was dismissed, his letter of resignation, and Cayenne's brother's letter dismissing him crossed in the mail.
I see. So just to kind of recap, what I think the main thing that kind of brought the center down at that point was this atmosphere of huge mistrust. And I think the volunteers, as you'll get testimony from them, all had different stories that they had to say about why they were losing trust in John as the director. And all of us felt that way about this woman, Wendy, as well. And so, you know, as I said to you on the phone, I don't really know the lowdown, the facts of exactly what was happening, because I don't have proof, but I did have very strong feelings that something, you know, fishy was going on, and I didn't feel safe myself in the situation. I mean, so that's basically what I feel like it was about, was just the atmosphere of mistrust. And I feel like, in a way, we couldn't get to the bottom of it. And before we did get to the bottom of it, John Judge bailed out of the situation.
Now, do you are saying that you were afraid? Because I have heard that from other members of the center and also from Cayenne herself. Why were you afraid?
Well, I can't really say why I was afraid, except that I just didn't have a basic sense of trust about John Judge or this woman, Wendy, at this point in time. When I first worked with him, I did, and at this point in time, there were so many reports from other people that were working with him that there were changes in his behavior, and I know the nature of this work. I had experienced May's death and the burning down of the house across from her street and all of that kind of environment that this work takes place in. And so, yes, obviously I was afraid because I didn't know who this woman was. She said she wanted to be, that day that she was at the meeting, she said, I want to be on the board. And we were kind of shocked. And the first thing we said was, how do you propose to be on the board if you live in Washington, D.C.? And she had another response such as, well, my work allows me to travel a lot. I can fly and be here for the meetings. And I don't know. It didn't add up, the whole situation. Apparently John Judge was madly in love with her. She was madly in love with him. But when I was in the room with them, it just didn't add up. So I don't know. All I can say is I have speculations, but I don't have any facts to prove it. And you know, I think we all had intuitions and feelings, and other people had more direct experiences. You can talk to them about it, but those were my feelings.
All righty, Karen. The one last thing I would like to ask you, I would like to get your response to the account provided in this Jonathan Vanken book about the demise of the Mae Brussels Center. Speaking of John Judge... He collected thousands, somewhere in the mid-five figures. Then a series of personal conflicts and health problems drove him back to the East Coast. The center collapsed to be resurrected by Davis and some associates as the Mae Brussels Library in Seaside, California. There was a string of problems with the center, one of them Judge's refusal to open it to the public. According to Davis, the new library will be open. But, says Davis, quote, one of the problems was Dave Emery, unquote. Davis says he personally implored Emory, to whom the Mae Brussels Research Center will always be, quote, so-called, unquote, not to attack the center on his show. In the fall of 1989, Emory burst. Restraining himself for a year, he could no longer hold it in and went on the air accusing Judge of financial improprieties and other sordid acts. In private, Emory is even more vitriolic. Whatever the objective reality of the Mae Brussels Research Center controversy, the version that navigates the canals of Dave Emery's brain is another of his many traumas. What is your reaction to both Vankin's discussion of what happened with the Mae Brussels Center, and that is the whole account, and also Tom Davis's observations in particular?
Well, basically, I feel like in that account, there's no accounting of all the problems that were coming directly from the people that were working in the center, that is, the volunteers. So it's, you know, right away I feel there's a huge gap in that account that doesn't include even what happened. And secondly, saying that you were a big problem about that caused part of the downfall of the center doesn't make sense to me at all, because I was there on the board, and, you know, I don't know about the bigger ramifications after the center closed, you know, what you going on the air might have done. But in terms of the actual closing of the center, that had nothing to do with it.
All righty, Karen, I want to thank you for your account, and I hope you stay well.
Okay.
All righty, thanks.
Thank you.
Goodbye now.
That concludes the last of the interviews with the volunteers from the Mae Brussels Center. Again, some of their information is subjective impression, should be taken with a grain of salt and viewed as no more than that. But obviously, many of the volunteers, most of whom I don't know at all, have a number of areas of intersection. Many of the female volunteers, including Cayenne, felt that John was sexist. I personally never saw that on his part, but then I had so little to do with John Judge or the Mae Brussels Center that one should take that with a grain of salt, too. I had very little to do with this fellow, and then next to nothing to do with the center. One of the reasons I find the account in this book so totally offensive, and frankly, it mocks me and mocks some of the most profound relationships and some of the most poignant and agonizing experiences of my life, and I will talk about that later. One of the things that I'm going to do now, or the thing I'm going to do now, and again, I think listeners are in a position to make up their own mind about why the volunteers quit and about why the center went down. And the charges, quote-unquote, of financial improprieties on Judge's part are facts. In the opinion of counsel, a couple of them are feloniously criminal, but that is the opinion of counsel. I'm not an expert in that regard. The account of the Mae Brussels Research Center that exists in Vankin's book, the serious X factors in this whole business. Speaking now, reading from Vankin's book about the Mae Brussels Research Center, of Mae and her dying, to encourage a healthier legacy. On her deathbed, she authorized that a research center be created in her name, donating her overstuffed files in plenary political library. Emory donated money to starting up the center, but the curatorship went to John Judge, with whom Emory has been embroiled in a simmering feud since 1984. Well, first of all, the phrasing of this saying, Emory donated money to starting up the center, which is true, and you'll hear that, but the curatorship went to John Judge, I think might very easily be interpreted by a reader, and perhaps was intended as such, to indicate that I somehow was jealous of John Judge getting the curatorship to the center. Well, in the first place, the center as a whole was John Judge's idea, not Mae Brussels, and at no point did I want to become director of the Mae Brussels Research Center. I would not have had time to do something like that and also do my radio work, and the radio work with me has always been paramount. And the differences between John Judge and myself, no mere personality conflict, as you will see, began in 1988, July of 88 specifically, not in 1984. Let's continue here with the account as I relate my own experiences. Judge also managed to get himself some lecture bookings and onto radio talk shows. According to Tom Davis, a longtime friend of Brussels whose mail-order book service is one of the best sources for political books, Judge and Emery had been, quote, competing for radio kudos, unquote, since at least 1984 when they were interviewed jointly on Los Angeles station KPFA and ended up in a vocal shoving match won by the indomitable larynx of Dave Emery. Emery swears that his differences with Judge are no mere personality conflict. Well, this is outright nonsense. I have had my own radio show for 12 or 13 years. John Judge does not have his own radio show. First of all, a minor editorial point, Los Angeles station KPFA, we'll know, of course, KPFA is in Berkeley, KPFK is the Pacifica station in Los Angeles. I mentioned this minor editorial mistake because the quality of information presented there, although minor and in a minor context, is every bit as fallacious and far-off base as virtually everything else Vankan has to say here. The appearance in question, and we don't have time this evening, but I'm going to play part of this alleged vocal shoving match won by the indomitable larynx of Dave Emery, simply never took place. I was not involved in a vocal shoving match at any point with John Judge, and certainly not in 1984. This particular appearance was on Barry Scott's The Secret's Out show on July 14th, 1984, and I will play you a portion of that broadcast next week. Mae Brussels appeared for the first hour, and then for the next 2 hours of Barry's show, it was John Judge and myself. And like I say, I will play a portion of that broadcast next week. The following day, that would have been Sunday, July 15th of 1991, Ken Ellis, who is one of KPFA's engineers, drove John Judge down to Los Altos Hills to appear as a guest on my program. On Saturday, July 7th of 1984, and Sunday, July 8th, and again on July 15th of 1984, I had been rebroadcasting the Guns of November program, originally recorded in November of 83, an archive show about the assassination of President Kennedy. After the conclusion of that broadcast, I had John Judge on as a guest on my program. Far from competing for radio kudos and all of this nonsense, John appeared as a guest on my program talking about connections between Jonestown and the Martin Luther King assassination. I then took those remarks and for a time included them, for 4 years in fact, included them as a section of Radio Free America program number 8 dealing with the assassination of Martin Luther King. Far from competing for radio kudos, and again, John does not have his own radio program, I do, I included the tape of that program, having had John on as a guest the night after this alleged vocal shoving match, etc., etc., and distributed his tape to other radio stations, actually giving John more exposure, more radio exposure than he otherwise would have had. We're going to hear now a short tape segment of Ken Ellis's recollection of him driving John Judge down to my program. This is about 8 minutes in length, as I recall. And I'm also going to talk with Ken about a right-wing tax protest group. Many of the members certainly appear to be innocent. Maybe most of them are, but some of them are definitely not. And I'm also going to get Ken Ellis's subjective reactions of some of the people in this particular group. So here is Ken Ellis, one of KPFA's engineers. Right now I'm speaking with Mr. Ken Ellis. Ken is, I believe, the chief engineer for radio station KPFA-FM, the Pacifica station in Berkeley. Am I right in saying you're the chief engineer, Ken?
Not exactly. We don't have a fancy title known as chief engineer at this moment. There are a few of us that are called engineers, studio engineers, transmitter engineers, but no chief engineers. We do have a operations director who is the head of our department, though.
Okay, well, in any event, before we get into the subject of our little discussion here, I want to extend some congratulations, and I believe I speak for the KPFA listening audience all over Northern California, for your work in helping to save KPFA's transmitter and keep the station going during the recent huge fire in Oakland. I guess, from what I heard, you were literally the boy on the burning deck, so to speak.
Well, actually, I maintained the grounds there for the previous 6 years, and I kept the brush from getting too close to our fence and, giving us the chance to get burned up by having a lot of dry fuel around.
All righty. Well, in any case, once again, congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, Ken, what I wanted to ask you about, in this book, Conspiracies, Cover-Ups, and Crimes by Jonathan Vankin, there is a statement that the problems between myself and John Judge began following an alleged verbal shoving match that took place in an appearance on KPFA in 1984. Now, next week, I'm going to play a section of this alleged verbal shoving match. It's simply fantasy. There was no verbal shoving match in 1984. And not only did I not, my differences with John Judge not begin then, they began in 1988, as I will be relating later in the broadcast. But after that particular appearance, and by the way, that was on the evening of July 14th, 1984, I appeared on Barry Scott's The Secrets Out show with Mae Brussel and John Judge. And the following evening, July 15th, 1984, you drove John Judge down to KFJC so that he could appear as a guest on my show. Did you recall that evening?
That's right. I recall both evenings, and to me it was rather exciting to have all these researchers get together, and there was no rancor or dissension amongst the troops that night that I can remember.
And again, I had John Judge down on my program the following evening. Specifically, I had been rebroadcasting The Guns of November about the assassination of President Kennedy that had been recorded in November of 1983, and I had John Judge on for a long period of time talking about the connections between Martin Luther King's assassination and Jonestown. We also took listener phone-ins at that time. I then took the tape of that broadcast and included it as part of Radio Free America number 8, dealing with the assassination of Martin Luther King, and continued to distribute that tape as part of RFA number 8, thereby giving John airplay on stations and in areas that he had not had airplay and consequent exposure in before, which is hardly competing for radio kudos, as is asserted in Vankin's book. And I will talk more about that later. One other thing I wanted to ask you about, Ken, you have for some time been attending meetings of a tax protest group called the Constitutional Patriots at one point. They have been renamed, have they not?
Yes. I don't know what happened to the Constitutional Patriots Association, but the group that I attend meetings of now is called the Free Enterprise Society.
So did it change its name, or did it change affiliations, do you know?
Well, that difference has never been made clear to me, and it just magically, changed its names. I was on the same mailing list, and it just seemed like there was a name change at one point.
Okay, because I know, for example, that you are certainly not an Aryan Nations or neo-Nazi type. Far from it. You've always been very supportive of my work and have been taping my programs religiously for many, many years. One of the problems that figured in my relationship with John Judge, such as it was that John was associating with members of the Constitutional Patriots Heritage Association. And it's clear from their literature that at least some of them are into identity Christianity and other similar Aryan Nations type of philosophies and activities. Now, for all I know, most of the people, perhaps the vast majority of the people in this group, are simply concerned with IRS problems and could not be placed in that category. What I was wondering is, have you ever seen any of these types, people that appear to be members of hate groups or have the identity Christianity or Aryan Nations orientation?
Well, the meetings that I attended were roughly in the period of 85 through 87.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, I remember they would often start the meetings with a prayer, and there seemed to be certain people there who had strong Christian beliefs who would preach a little bit before the meeting actually got started. And I remember another person, his first name was Dave, who actually had a shootout with the police on a freeway one night, and he ended up not surviving that shootout. It was reported to me that he jumped out of the car. I believe the vehicle had been stopped for just a minor driving infraction, and he, in his some kind of paranoid craze, jumped out of the car and said, "You're never going to take me alive," and started shooting at the police, who apparently were able to overpower him and, I guess, shot him dead at the side of the road. And I remember this particular person named Dave, who had actually delivered a lecture that was supposed to be originally about survival. And the lecture turned out to be spun around on its heels a little bit, and was and it happened to turn out to be one about firearms. And about halfway into it, the leader of the group happened to stop the lecture dead in its tracks, saying that if the police were ever to send an agent into a meeting like this and to hear the kind of stuff that was going on about firearms, they would probably, try to make big trouble for the whole group. So he stopped the lecture, and then it was not too long after that that this particular Dave had his run-in with the police, and was never, of course, heard from again.
Well, obviously not if he was killed. I mention this because, as I say, there were individuals from the aforementioned Constitutional Patriots Heritage Association around Judge. It's virtually every place I saw him, and it's obvious from their literature that some of them, at least, are into identity Christianity, and that the organization as a whole, perhaps not the Berkeley group that you were attending the meetings of, but some of the chapters, at least, appear to be quite tolerant of identity Christianity and similar philosophies. I bring this up because, again, that was a factor in my relationship with John Judge. But that's all I wanted to ask you about, Cannon. I appreciate your taking the time to relate your experiences with us. And once again, I want to congratulate you for your role in helping to keep KPFA out of the toaster.
Well, thank you, Dave.
And that was the interview with Ken Ellis. And one thing I want to clarify is that I know Ken. He's a long-time trusted associate and a fine person. We don't always see eye to eye on everything, which is not necessary for any kind of personal or professional relationship. I respect Ken's right to associate with whom he wants to associate, and Ken was concerned that people might view the remarks that he made as indicating he's part of a hate group. That is not the case. According to Ken's own account, and I've never attended a meeting of the Berkeley chapter, the most of the people involved in that chapter appear to be progressives from Berkeley who are concerned with having their tax dollars used for military spending, and that apparently is one of Ken's main reasons for being involved with this group. I don't know how typical the Berkeley chapter of the former Constitutional Patriots Heritage Association is. It is not unreasonable to suppose that the Berkeley chapter is more liberal than some of the others, given the progressive political orientation of so many people in Berkeley. But when we come back to this Constitutional Patriots Heritage Association, and I will detail the intersection, the indeterminate relationship that John had with elements of this group. I know he met with a chapter of this group, a gathering of this group, on at least one occasion. And every place I saw John Judge, I saw people from this group. Most of the people in the group may be perfectly innocent for all I know, and I have no way of assessing the individual guilt or innocence of any individual, but I want to make it very, very clear, lest the rumor mills get started, that Ken Ellis is a longtime trusted associate and a very fine fellow, and in no way should this be interpreted as indicating that Ken himself is part of a hate group or anything of that kind. So let's prevent those rumors from getting started before they get started, if in fact they are going to get started. As indicated, far from a verbal shoving match, quote-unquote, and you're going to hear some of that alleged verbal shoving match next week when I, during at least the first hour or so of the show, I'm going to wrap up this particular account, this dealing with the Vanken book. I had John Judge down, as I mentioned. I took the tape, distributed it as part of my own program, giving him more exposure than he had previously had. As you've already heard, and as many people, including Paul from Archives on Audio, can testify, on October 9th, 1988, when I had John as a guest on my program, I offered him the position of being my co-host because Niptuck had left. It was already clear to me at this point that John and I were on a collision course in an attempt to prevent that because I was deeply wounded by May's death. I offered him a position of being co-host, and as we shall see, I also was hoping to teach John how to do research properly, which, as we shall see, he does not know how to do. That was the first, those were the first two times I ever saw John Judge. Oh, by the way, this fanciful and this flight of fancy that Vanken engages in here, John and Dave competing for radio kudos since at least 1984. I gave John more distribution than he would ever have had, distributed tapes of his material for 4 years from 1984 through 88 when I began having my differences with him, and then offered him a position of being my co-host on October 9th, 1988, something, by the way, Tom Davis was aware of. I called him after reading this nonsense in this book and asked him if he had in fact said that, and Tom Davis remembered that I had offered John Judge the position of co-host. I don't know whether he neglected to mention that or whether Jonathan Vanken neglected to put it in his book, but it should be noted for the record. The only way you could interpret all of that as, quote, competing for radio kudos, unquote, is literally if you don't understand the English language. That ain't competing for radio kudos. When I offered John my position to the position of co-host, I'm doing about as much for anybody as I could, and I neither liked nor respected nor trusted him at that point, but I didn't want to have to expend more emotional energy and experience more emotional suffering on the heels of May's death than I already did. The next time I saw John Judge was in March of 1987, when again John and myself and May Brussel appeared as a guest on Barry Scott's The Secrets Out show. In that particular broadcast, John and I were tripping over each other's toes to a certain extent. There was no verbal shoving match, no hostility of any kind, and I continued to distribute the tapes of John's program at that from that point until my differences began with him in 88. Perhaps that's what Tom Davis was thinking of, but it could never... We had different agendas, and we were tripping over each other's feet to a certain extent, but there was no hostility of any kind, no rancor, and there just was not a verbal shoving match. And I suspect that is what is navigating the canals of Tom Davis's brain under the circumstances. The next time I saw John Judge was in February of 1988, and that was when there was a potluck at May Brussel's house, and this was a premium for the marathon that had been held on KFJC the previous fall. People who donated $100 or more were able to attend this particular potluck dinner. There are no doubt listeners in the audience who were there, and John Judge was there, and there was no interaction of any significant kind. We simply exchanged pleasantries and talked about what was going on, and that was it. The next time I saw, well, actually, I shouldn't say I saw John Judge because I never actually physically met him, but my differences with John Judge began in July of 1988, specifically at the so-called Fourth Reich Conference. This was a conference that was held in San Francisco, originally, I believe, scheduled for June of 88, and then rescheduled to July 13th of 1988, working from memory. I know it was July of 88. I'm pretty sure it was July 13th. Now, at this particular conference, John Judge was sort of in charge with organizing it. I was invited to speak there, so was May Brussel, but by this point, she had already been stricken with cancer, so she was not able to attend. I told John that there were a number of people there that I did not care for. They shall go nameless under the circumstances, but they range from people on the extreme left to people on the extreme right, and I didn't want anything to do with either of them. I received John's assurances that they would not be there. In fact, they were all there. Beyond that, John appeared on Michael Krasny's show on the radio station KGO-AM, a major AM station here in the Bay Area, and liberally dropped my name in helping to promote this particular forthright conference. Again, I had received John's assurance that certain people would not be there. They were there. That is why I did not attend that particular conference. I made up the white lie of car trouble at the time because I didn't want to get into talking about my differences with John Judge.